Locked On NBA, the biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. Today, we will stop in Indiana to speak with Tony East of Locked On Pacers about how Victor Oladipo has looked since his return from injury. We go to Houston to speak with Jackson Gatlin of Locked On Rockets about the small ball Rockets and how they have matched up against some of the bigger teams in the NBA and what it means for the playoffs. And lastly, we go to Boston to speak with John Corrales of Locked On Celtics about a disappointing loss against the Lakers on Sunday, Kemba Walker's knee, and Jason Tatum's elevation to pretty close to superstar level. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
Are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to another week of Locked On NBA. I am your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I'm also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball Podcast and the lead analyst at BasketballMonster.com and at Yahoo Sports Australia. The NBA playoffs, we're getting really close to those beginning. There's some interesting things heating up across the NBA, so we're going to cover a lot of that today. So let's get to it. Now I'm joined by one of the hosts of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Tony East is here with me. Victor Oladipo is back. Well, he's sort of back, I guess, Tony. He's back and playing, but now he is dealing with a back injury. How have you seen the first eight games of Oladipo's return from that ruptured quad tendon?
It was really rough at first, both between just a player returning from such a long injury and inserting such a high minutes guy into a lineup that had been functioning pretty well. It was rough. They escaped with a win in their first game, then lost six in a row before. Now they've won two straight, but it was against the Knicks and the Giannis-less Bucks, so not exactly a murderer's row of opponents. But he personally is shooting horribly from everywhere, 33% overall, 25% from three. And I think with his shooting at the rim, he's just not super used to contact yet, and his shot's not fully under him from deep. I mean, these are things that you expect from a guy who's missed over a year, and you could tell. It's mostly past this point now, but for probably the first six games or so, there were a lot of lineup jitters where guys didn't know how to play off of him because, if you remember, the Pacers signed so many new guys this summer that have never played in games with him before that there were some awkward timing issues and spacing issues that they had to iron out. Some of those are going away, and that's probably why they've won. That's more of why they've won their last two games. But There were some kinks to iron out that made everybody else struggle a little bit, and he himself, obviously, is still working back from not playing basketball for over a year.
So he's come back in these eight games. He's got a usage of almost 26%, which is still a little bit down from where it was last year, but still pretty high. Do you think that with some of the struggles with his shooting, and you touched on all those numbers, which have not looked good at all, that there is your reason for McMillan to perhaps steer away from Oladipo a little bit in terms of the touches or the way the offense flows back to how it was before? Or do you think it's just a matter of, we've just got to keep persisting because if we want to get anywhere in the playoffs, he needs to get back to that player. So we've got to ride out some of these rough games early on and get him back to being at least close to the guy that he was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a little bit of both is the boring answer there, right? So he, in his third game, he took 17 shots. He only made four, and they lost that game by nine. Who knows if you swing that to 10 shots and you have seven more shots for guys who have been playing all season, how that game ends up. And since then, he's really throttled it down. In the last two games that they've won, he's taken 15 shots total as opposed to that 17 in one game. So a lot of that usage rate is from the earlier games where he was getting the ball a lot more, and because he wasn't starting and he was with the bench units, he got the ball more often than he is now. But I think now that he is with the starters and with their last three games, they've had the starting five they expected when they signed everybody this summer. His usage has dropped within that group. He's been more deferring in general. Three and four assist games in there. And then he had one against the Knicks, but he left early with a back injury. And his shot total going down. His percentages are going up, too, because he's taking better shots as that usage drops. So that's helpful for him because he doesn't have to, shoot his way through the rust and get back to being Vic faster. He can kind of fit in with the guys a little more. And it's helpful for everybody else because they get the closer to the touch numbers they're accustomed to before he returned. So that's been helpful for them winning their last two games.
Yeah, back in that breakout 17-18 season, he was a real terror defensively. He averaged almost 2.5 steals. He averaged almost a block a game in both of those career highs. But so far since returning, those numbers have been non-existent. I think he's had one block in his 8 games. He's had only 4 steals through 8 games. Is that just an 8-game sample size anomaly, or is he just not as active on those end on that end and the timing is off?
His defense has been okay. Not the level, of course, of the season you're talking about. He was ridiculous that year. But yeah, some of it is the timing's off. He's not used to it. And the different factor of it is, you know, the guys he shared the court with in 17-18, Bojan Bogdanovic, Darren Collison, these guys are terrible perimeter defenders. So Oladipo's guarding the ball a lot more often. Whereas now, Nate McMillan's really comfortable putting TJ Warren on the ball handlers, which who would have thought that a few seasons ago? And Brogdon has been an awesome defender, and they have some good bench defenders as well who can contain the perimeter. So Oladipo is actually away from the play more often, which is good because he's, you know, getting his legs under, getting back up to game speed. But that does take him out of situations to get steals and blocks. So those numbers are naturally down from his role, but also down because he has less, you know, he's less tenacious and less aggressive as he has been in prior seasons.
One last question on Oladipo, the back injury, which forced him out of the Knicks game, and now he's not playing on Sunday as well. How worried should we be? Is there any sort of compensation issue there in terms of recovery from the quad that may have caused this problem? Like, what are we looking at with this current back situation?
That's possible, though the team hasn't, no one has explicitly said anything to that effect yet. He was questionable to return in the Knicks game specifically. You know, they didn't think it was super severe at the time. And he didn't practice in between the Knicks game and the Raptors game. So that maybe could raise a flag. But he's listed as questionable on the official injury report. So I think it just seems like he got, you know, maybe there's a little bit of not playing for a year and then coming back and, you know, favoring whatever your body's not ready for. But I just think it's like a classic little Nick, and he'll be back in a few days and ready to go.
So this team is currently 33-23 in the sixth seed there, 13 wins ahead of the Wizards, who are in ninth. So it feels pretty safe to say that they're going to be in the playoffs. So these last, you know, 20-plus games of the season, what is it about for the Pacers? Is it trying to push into home court advantage? Is it trying to reintegrate Oladipo and get things moving there smoothly? Are they willing to sacrifice some of these losses in order to get that stuff happening and working at a higher level than it has been? Like, what are we expecting over the last 20-plus games here?
They talked about a little bit pushing for home court at the tail end of the All-Star break, right when they were coming back for practices. Catching Toronto and even Boston is going to be very challenging. But Miami's not completely out of the question. Now, they lost their opening game to the Hawks coming out of the break. So they're, I think, 3 games back of Miami right now, something like that, 3. Pretty close to that. So that's reasonable, and they play Miami in March. So they could, and that would even, or excuse me, they can tie the season series with Miami. They play 2 more times. So they could catch them in theory if things go well. So I think that's going to be goal number one. And if depending on how long Simmons is out and things with the Sixers, if they catch Miami, they could also catch Philly. But if things don't go well in this late February, early March stretch and they realize they're probably locked into 6, I don't think they'll push too hard for home court anymore, because for them even, it might be better to try to focus on reintegrating Oladipo and not be in the Bucks bracket, and just hope you can win the 6-3 and not have to play Milwaukee in the conference semifinals should you peak at the right time. So I'd imagine that, yeah, they'll go for home court for as long as they feel is right. And if they're going to get it, great, keep going for it. But if not, maybe focus on seeing how he fits the perfect possible way so you can be peaking come playoff time. Because Lord knows, I mean, if they have the perfect first-round matchup, maybe go for the 4-5 seed, but avoiding the Bucks is a reasonable objective.
Yeah, I think a lot of teams in the East will be hoping that they can avoid the Bucks as long as possible. Tony, you're going to have it all covered for us over on Locked On Pacers over the coming weeks and months and into the playoffs, so everyone can go check out your thoughts over there. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Yeah, Josh, of course. Thanks for having me.
When you start your hiring process, you may have questions. Will you find good applicants to choose from? What about education and experience? And how will you know you've made the right hire? Indeed is here to help. Millions of great candidates use Indeed every day to find their next opportunity. You can post a job in minutes and use screener questions to help create your short list of applicants fast. Also, add skills tests to your job post so you can be confident in your applicant's abilities. Their library of more than 50 skills tests ranges from industry-specific skills like accounting to general aptitude tests like critical thinking. Indeed gives you the smart tools to make hiring decisions quickly and to be confident that you're making the right hire for your team. Post your job today at Indeed.com/LockedOn and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/LockedOn. Terms, conditions, and exclusions apply. Offer valid through March 31, 2020. Now we talk to the host of the Locked On Rockets podcast. Jackson Gatlin is here with me today. Houston has been obviously bucking the trend of the entire history of the NBA by not playing any tall people at all. It seems to be working okay, Jackson, at the moment.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, obviously at first there were a lot, even myself, I wasn't sure if I completely bought into the small ball lineup at first. But things have looked phenomenal. The spacing that is being provided now for Russell Westbrook and James Harden, you know, to operate with without having a traditional big kind of clogging up the paint. You know, it's a small sample size. They are currently five games in since the official acquisition of Robert Covington. However, overall, they are 8-2 in games which Clint Capella didn't play while he was still on the roster, and they opted to start PJ Tucker. So I guess you can look at it so far. They're 8-2 in the small ball era.
Yeah, they've had a couple of losses since that Covington trade. One was a real weird blowout against the Suns, then that one-point buzzer-beater loss against the Jazz, which on Saturday they rectified with a 10-point victory. So they've had some challenges against big teams, a 10-point win over the Lakers, a 10-point win over the Jazz. You're going up against Anthony Davis and Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee, then, of course, Rudy Gobert. How much of this is just, you know, confusing those opposing big men and you're sort of putting them in a position where it's not their ideal scenario versus the benefit it gives to someone like a Russell Westbrook who does need that extra space, being that he is a non-shooter himself?
Well, I think one thing that it's definitely doing, and this is something that is kind of befuddling other teams, is, you know, teams are looking at this small ball lineup, you know, 6'5 PJ Tucker, 6'5 James Harden, you know, 6'3 Westbrook, whatever it may be. And they're looking at these guys and thinking that they have an advantage by getting guys like JaVale McGee the ball in the paint just because they're bigger. That's not necessarily the case whatsoever. They are, you know, other teams are being forced into this idea that they have an advantage when they really don't. PJ Tucker is immovable in the paint. James Harden is in the 95th percentile as far as paint defense is concerned. And because the Rockets constantly switch everything, those two guys are defending a lot of bigs in the paint and doing it well. And then on top of that, Robert Covington, I think the area that he has been most effective in is as a weak side help defender, something that Clint Capella wasn't necessarily, you know, bad at, but not nearly as successful as Robert Covington based on, you know, just with his athleticism, with his agility and his ability to kind of come over as the weak side defender and provide some help. You know, we saw it, you know, a couple times against the Jazz in the most recent game that the Rockets played, where Covington would swing over from the weak side and, you know, suddenly he's just this wall with that 7'2 wingspan. I mean, he had I think it's four blocks and then three blocks against the Jazz. Those are his block totals for the last three games. So he is definitely a shot blocker, even though he's not a traditional big. He's still able to use his length and his athleticism to contest shots right at the rim.
He's doing that. He's hit multiple threes in every game bar one outside of that Suns game as well, and block shots in every game except for that game against Phoenix as well, Covington. So providing some real defensive rim protection there as well. And that point you make about guys like Tucker and Harden being super strong and really hard for those big men to move, I think is a key point of it. It's not just all about height. It's about having that strength to be able to, you know, prevent those players from getting close to the rim and then giving less skilled guys that opportunity because of a perceived mismatch. And that is working in the Rockets' favor. Now, I guess the big question, Jackson, is that when teams have seven games to really sit down and prepare for this, which is something completely different, and teams don't do a huge amount of team-specific game planning through the regular season, well, majority of times they don't, and this is something that they just don't see versus the other 28 teams that they have to face during the year. So when we get into a playoff series, how solvable do you think this is? How quick can adjustments come? Is that going to be a downfall for the Rockets?
I think it's honestly really hard to say at this point. This is the first time that we've really seen this level of small ball being played. I mean, let's face it, Boston, you know, has been doing it, you know, honestly for a few years now, this whole kind of positionless basketball, so to speak. But the Rockets have really seemingly taken it to another level by playing, you know, this group of lineup, you know, this lineup that's essentially guards and forwards. You know, there are no bigs. There are no traditional bigs on this team. Jeff Green is now their biggest player, standing at a towering 6'9", and that's what you get out of him at the backup five spot. So I think it's really hard to say whether or not a team will successfully be able to game plan over the course of a seven-game series. Honestly, the way that they're playing right now, offensively, they're still going to be one of the most potent teams in the league. And they're generating, unfortunately, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but they've, since the trade was consummated and Robert Covington became a Houston Rocket, they are now generating more wide open threes than they were before. And if I'm not mistaken, they were already generating the most wide open threes in the entire NBA. So not only now is their offense more potent, they've got more shooters, they're operating with more space. Their defensive identity has also shifted from one where they're not so much concerned about stopping. You know, with Capella, they were using him as kind of their defensive anchor, and it was really up to him to kind of close off some of these drives to kind of shore up their weak perimeter defense. Now they've kind of, they understand they're going to get out-rebounded at points in games, but they're causing so much chaos on that side of the basketball. I believe since the Robert Covington trade has happened, they're number one in the league in forced turnovers, and they are also taking better care of the basketball and have, I think they're somewhere around first or second as far as turnovers committed in that same time span. So five games or so, which if they can continue to do that, I just don't know how another team is necessarily going to be able to exploit them even over the course of a seven game series.
One last thing, you mentioned Jeff Green coming in to be their backup center. They also acquired Damari Carroll, who had an interesting social media post over the weekend that seemed that he was a little bit displeased with his new role on his new team. Is that how you read that, and does that cause any problems in the locker room?
Hopefully it doesn't. I am one to just wait until there's a legitimate source that comes out, either whether it's Kelly Eco with the Athletic or Jonathan Sagan with the Houston Chronicle, you know, one of the two main beat writers for the team, you know, these guys who travel with the team, or not with the team specifically, but, you know, go city to city following the team and, you know, are much closer than all the other traditional media are to the team. I'm going to wait until I get some concrete evidence from one of those guys, because frankly, yes, it was a bit disconcerting to see that posted on social media. However, it was taken down, so maybe somebody said something to him about it. Not quite sure what all is going on there, but I'm sure somebody within the organization talked to him and said, hey, you know, go ahead and get rid of that. Look, we're going to find you some minutes. We're going to find you some time. And I think there's enough veteran voices in that locker room, you know, Tyson Chandler being one of the big ones. Just recently there was a short little video of him talking to them after the Utah Jazz win, kind of regrouping the team and everything. So there's enough veteran presence in that locker room that I think whatever issue there may be as far as, you know, minutes played or, you know, available minutes, I feel like they'll be able to squash those concerns pretty quickly. This is a team that just cares about winning, and they don't really care about individual stats or accolades. They want to come together and win no matter what. It doesn't matter who's averaging what points, doesn't matter who's getting a triple-double. They just want to win. And so I think, you know, once they convey that to Damari Carroll, I feel like he'll be a bit more at ease with the environment.
It's going to be interesting to see. Of course, this team is, you know, completely bucking the trend or how any team has played in the NBA before. So it's nightly must-watch viewing, and we'll see how far that takes them in the postseason. Jackson, you'll have it covered for us all over on Locked On Rockets. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Absolutely. Anytime, my man.
Let's bring in the host of the Locked On Celtics podcast now. John Corrales is here with me just after the Celtics went down narrowly to the Lakers on Sunday, 114-112. John, do you think that that performance from Boston can be taken as a positive? We know there's controversy at the end of that game, but on the road against a team that's, you know, well up in the Western Conference, I think the Celtics have some positives to take out of that one.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's a team that, you know, is possibly going to be hosting an NBA Finals game here. So playing them this tight in this situation, I think there are certainly positives. And even with the things that went wrong at the end of the game, those are learning experiences for the Celtics and for Jason Tatum, who had mostly a phenomenal game. But the way they defended him in the fourth quarter is a way that he hasn't seen defenses play him. So he'll have an opportunity to really look at some of the things that the Lakers did and learn from it. So to come in here and play without Kemba Walker and have a chance to win the game is all you can ask for. And then maybe a couple of breaks go your way and this becomes a win instead of a loss.
Currently, the Celtics are sitting in the 3 spot in the Eastern Conference, a couple of games behind the Raptors. That'll probably change. We're recording this as the Raptors are currently blowing out the Pacers. A couple of games ahead of Miami, you know, 2 or 3 games behind Toronto in that 3 spot, which is probably the most likely area they finish this season. But a lot of that's going to come down to what is actually happening with Kemba Walker, who has missed the 2 games after the All-Star break with knee soreness after receiving an injection. He did play 29 minutes and allegedly pushed through his minutes restriction in that All-Star game. How worried should we be here with Kemba?
I'm a little more worried than I was a couple of weeks ago, and which was not very worried at all. The Celtics continue to downplay the extent of the knee soreness. They're saying that he's not missing time necessarily because the knee doesn't allow him to play. He's missing time to strengthen the knee, and so he doesn't miss more time later on. So according to the Celtics, this is something that is, I mean, obviously lingering, but their approach is to have him rest a little bit as he recovers and strengthen that leg. So as Brad Stevens said today, they're going to need him to play some big minute games later on this season in the playoffs. So instead of getting him back and kind of gutting him through 25 to 30 minutes, they want to make sure that he's back and right and ready to kind of ramp up his minutes towards the end of the season. It's almost the same approach that they had with Al Horford last season when he missed most of December with knee soreness. It was something that he could have pushed through if they really wanted him to and if he really wanted to. But they're taking this approach to, according to them, strengthen the knee and kind of get him ready for the end of the season and the playoffs.
I guess in this sort of spot where they're sitting at the moment in terms of, you know, being sort of 3 games back from the 2 and 3 games up from the 4 seed, they do have a little bit of a room there to, you know, I guess, prepare themselves for that playoff push by sitting Kemba some of these games. So I think that's part of it. Like, they're not, like, you know, half a game back from getting that home court over the Raptors potentially and not likely to drop out of the top 4 there or into the Bucks side of the bracket. So they're sitting fairly comfortably. So I think they can be a little bit more judicious in how they play Kemba. But it's also the fact that they've got other guys who are capable. Marcus Smart steps into the point guard role. You've got Brad Wanamaker, who stepped up and played well at times. Sometimes you'll be Romeo Langford getting minutes, and you'll get guys like Tremont Waters step in and play some spot minutes in those situations. So it's not like Charlotte, where with Kemba was out, they're completely destitute. There's other players who can step in there. So preserving his knee does seem like the prudent course of action. But yeah, it is obviously worrying when a guy who's pushing up towards that 30-year-old mark and has had persistent knee problems over what is like about a month now, and it just doesn't seem to be getting better. So it is something to watch. But again, being cautious is probably the best level here for Boston to take. Let's go back to Tatum. We talked about him a little bit more at the start. He has really elevated his game. Early in this season, there were some efficiency issues with his shooting. It just wasn't really there. What has been the biggest change that you would say from him over the last, 3 to 4 weeks? It's really seen him, firmly establish himself, I think, as the Celtics' best player.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of factors. One is just shooting with a lot of confidence, the confidence to go out there and say, hey, you know, as soon as he was named an All-Star, his game went to another level. So, I mean, just knowing that basketball players be playing with a level of confidence, shooting with a level of confidence, there is just a different sort of swagger, a tendency that for the ball to go in when you're carrying yourself like that. But he's also taking better shots. I think he spent the beginning parts of the season kind of experimenting with his game. In the first month or so, where he was missing all of those layups, he was just attacking, diving towards the rim every single time without worrying about, like, really what the result would be. And then he had a stretch where he was just taking a bunch of floaters, like, for about a week or two. It was nothing but floaters in the middle of the lane. And now we're starting to see kind of like, all right, I learned this lesson from attacking the rim. I learned this lesson from taking the floaters. I learned this lesson from the other thing. Like, he had a stretch where he was taking a ton of step back threes. Now he's kind of weaving all of those things in, having gone through the film and figuring out what works, what didn't, what's best in what situation. And when you mix all of that together, now you're starting to see a very well-rounded game. And on top of all of that, he's playing with teammates, Kemba Walker when he's healthy, Gordon Hayward, who are extraordinarily good players, but also willing to take a step back and let him cook, let him ascend to that level. Jaylen Brown as well. Jaylen kind of fits very nicely with Jason Tatum's game, plays off him very well. So you've got learning lessons, you've got a maturing game, you've got teammates that kind of help him along the way, and it's all kind of come together right now for Tatum to kind of take this next step, and you can really see how in the years moving forward, he could become a guy that will be the Celtics' number one option as he gets out of his rookie contract into his next extension and in those years beyond.
Yeah, you can definitely see that. It's very clear that, you know, when we're watching the Celtics in 3 years' time, that he's going to be, you know, 24, 25 points a game pretty comfortably in that number one type of role. The foundations are clearly there, and that step forward has been quite noticeable over the last month or so. John, it is interesting times for Boston. We hope for the sake of, you know, really strong playoffs that Kemba is ready to go and things continue to progress, but you'll have us all updated on that over on Locked On Celtics. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
You got it. Thanks.
And that will do it for another episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Spotify. And a 5-star rating and review is an awesome way of letting us know and letting others know how much you like the show. Follow me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble. And you can follow the Locked On Podcast Network at Locked On NBA Net on both Twitter and on Instagram. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.